This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. We've got an absolutely fantastic show for you today featuring a superstar OnlyFans cam girl turned data scientist who's also an unapologetic champion of capitalism. It's going to be great, but before we get to it, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, CrowdHealth. I don't need to tell you that we've got a healthcare problem in this country. The government is expanding its reach, ultimately seeking something like Medicare or Medicaid for all. Many of you may already be on healthcare.gov plans, and if you are, you might want to ditch them and try something new, CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is not insurance. It's an alternative way to pay your healthcare bills. No surprise bills, no doctor networks. Healthcare can return to being between you and your doctor without the government or the health insurance companies getting in the way. Check it out now at joincrowdhealth.com. All one word, joincrowdhealth.com, and enter the promo code REASON to get the service for just $99 a month for 3 months. Joincrowdhealth.com. And now, on to today's show. I want you to meet Ayla, the daughter of evangelical Christians from Idaho who were so poor they couldn't always put food on the table. A former factory worker who's never graduated college, Ayla became one of the most successful performers on the adult subscription site OnlyFans, sometimes earning over $100,000 a month on the platform. She still does one-on-one appointments, but only with clients who can afford to pay her current rate of $3,000 an hour. But now Ayla is as well known for being a data scientist and for her oddball social media polls, for sexy and silly personal moments on Twitter, and for using her giant platform to spread hot libertarian takes, such as declaring, "I like capitalism. I'm not okay with you making laws that prevent me from doing what I feel is good for me," she says. Ayla is also an outspoken defender of sex worker rights. She compares her current life to what it was like when she was 19, when she would wake up at 4:30 in the morning to go do repetitive tasks on an assembly line in a windowless factory, often putting in well over 50 hours a week. Why do people talk about survival sex work, but not like survival factory work or survival burger flipping, she wonders. Yes, she grants there's exploitation in sex work, but decriminalizing sex work, she says, would let workers actually go get police help if they needed it. Reason's Liz Wolf met up with Ayla at her home in Austin, Texas, for a wide-ranging conversation about everything from how sex work has made her a better data scientist to why so many successful practitioners in her industry are selling not just sex, but the personal connections that so many of us are missing in our lives. Here is the Reason interview with Ayla.
So, do you recall the moment you first decided, hey, I'm going to put my naked body on the internet?
Damn, what an opening. Yeah, I'd worked at a factory for a year and it was really terrible.
What type of factory?
I was on an assembly floor, assembly electrical relays. So they're like used in electrical systems to like go off and protect us or manage. I don't remember, it was a long time ago. But I was standing on the floor and like my little uniform on an assembly line doing the repetitive motion over and over again. And we worked long hours, like 50 hours a week. We had to be there at like 5 a.m. and left, you know, 3 or something like that. And it was terrible. It worked Saturdays and it was just absolutely mind killing. Because it's the kind of work, I'm just going to go into detail, let me know if this is too much detail. Because it's the kind of work that's like very, you have to pay enough attention that you can't let your mind wander, but it's not interesting enough to be interesting. So it was really soul killing. And then after that, I was like, okay, fuck this. I'm just never going to work for a boss again. I'm going to try and do my own thing. And I was really incompetent. So I failed at doing my own thing. But then I was like briefly dating this guy and he said, hey, there's this camming thing. You can like stream yourself live. And you know, if you want, I can help you do that. And we ended up never doing it. But after we broke up, I was sitting there like sleeping on my friend's couch, being like, what the fuck do I do? I guess I'll just try this thing.
Interesting. And so you got into camming, and what was that like initially?
Really scary. because I had come from an extremely conservative culture, like really, really conservative.
What and, religious background is your family?
Christian, fundamentalist, okay. Calvinist, evangelical.
Oh, Calvinist. Yeah. Wow, that's an interesting background.
Yeah, you know
yeah.
about the Calvinists?
Familiar with them.
Yes.
Scared of them, slightly.
Yes. Yeah, we were Calvinists. My dad is a professional evangelical debater. Goes around debating people about the Bible and stuff.
So from Calvinism to factory to camming, basically.
There were a couple intermediary steps, but roughly, yeah.
And what was that new life like when you started camming? Like, was it something where you immediately found it was a lot more stimulating in terms of thinking of your strategy and how to make money for yourself and how to really provide for yourself? Or was it the type of thing where you actually realized that parts of it were just as tedious as the factory work had been?
Eventually, but for mm-hmm. a long time, it was extremely good.
Okay.
Camming was a way that I could actually sort of like better myself. In a lot of the previous things, jobs I've been working like in my life, I'd had a very like small expectation of what my life could be. Because mm-hmm. I was brought up to be a housewife who would maybe marry a middle manager somewhere and, you know, have five kids immediately. And so when I was like, okay, that's not the life for me. I didn't have like, oh, I could go to college, right? And I could become a lawyer. Like that was just not in the cards. And so when I started camming, I made $60 the first night, and I was like, this is more money for 4 hours of work than I've seen in my lifetime. I was extremely excited. And it was something where I could actually like see results from working really hard. And that was the first time I'd been put into a system where I could work really hard and have like concrete results from it. And so I just became obsessed with it. I lived it, breathed it, went to sleep thinking about strategies. I had a lot of fun. I put on really creative shows, and it was awesome for several years. And eventually it got old, you know, because it's repetitive.
So after it got a little bit more tedious and rote, it seems like you moved to escorting, and escorting requires in-person interaction. What appealed to you about this? Did this feel like a really big step?
It did, kind of surprisingly. There's sort of a cultural like line inside of the cam girl world. You know, there are cam girls who like do escorting, cam girls who just don't do that. And it's very similar to like normal women in life. You're just like, oh, I would never kind of do sex work in the same way.
Like,
cam
I believe
girls.
In abortion, but I would never get one myself. It's yeah. like I believe in escorting, but I would never do that myself.
Right. And so in the cam girl land, there was like, oh, we're all cam girls, of course, but we never actually fuck a man for money. That's like a little. And then there are a couple cam girls who did it, and you would like gossip about it or something. And so I had sort of this idea that I wasn't that kind of person, really. Mm-hmm. I had absorbed a lot of cultural fears about it. I had something in the back of my head that was like, oh, if I accept sex for money, I'm going to be like dirty or gross or feel bad. It's going to be psychically damaging or something.
Do you think those were Calvinist cultural fears or camming world cultural fears?
I think
because it seems like there are taboos and stigmas coming from sort of both areas in an interesting way.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's not even just those two. It's the entire world.
Yeah.
It's everybody thinks that escorts are not sexually valuable, like as a mate. I mean, to fuck, yeah, but like not to like impregnate.
What was escorting like? Tell me a little bit about that transition. Did that require you basically acquiring an entirely new skill set, or was it something where you were able to build off of some of the creativity and the personal brand that you'd almost carved out for yourself via camping?
Oh, they were totally related. It was really interesting to go into escorting because I'd had a very long history of working really hard as a successful cam girl.
And how many hours were you working a week?
When at the height of it, probably like 30.
Okay.
My top month, I was working 40, maybe a little more than that, which is very exhausting, by the way. It's like live, like live improv for that. It's just absolutely mentally exhausting. But yeah, so escorting was great. I felt like I came into escorting expecting it to be kind of hard, but found that a lot of the skills that I had from camming just very naturally went over to marketing. Like I already at this point understood what men want in a pretty intuitive level. I knew the kind of photos that worked really well. I knew the kind of like personality and strategy that men really respond to.
What types of things do they respond well to, your clients?
Yeah, so men want personality. They really do. Like, and there's some sort of this fantasy that you're selling the guy on. Like, I'm not just like a body for you to fuck. I'm some sort of like escapism that you can kind of like fall in love with for a night. Who's, you know, warm and bubbly and fun to be around and like makes you feel great about yourself and a little bit therapy involved too.
Is it like a summoning a sort of manic pixie dream girl type vibe, or is it like a different form of charm?
Oh, it's pretty manic pixie. Yeah. At least a bit, right? And obviously girls have different strategies, right? There's a couple of girls with strategies that work who are very different from me. But yeah, usually you want to be like the dream girl who's like careless, who like desperately wants to suck your dick, who's like really excited about life, who's going to like bring you out of your mundanity. And so I just like put that into my marketing for escorting, and it went really well.
What did that look like? Like, what did the economics of camming look like, and then the economics of escorting? What did your business model look like?
With camming, most of the income comes from a small percentage of men, because the men are visible to each other, and so there's much higher competition. Like, as a guy, if you're, like, tipping the girl or giving her money, it's in front of other men, which means that if you don't have enough money, you are discouraged from tipping the woman, because you're going to, like, sort of lose the competition. It's very competition-oriented. And so you end up with a system where, like, 80% of your money comes from, like, two guys. Basically.
Wow, really?
Oh, yeah, it's extreme. And this leads to a lot of vulnerability for emotional abuse, too. Like, if all of your money or like is coming from just a handful of guys, then they can make a lot of demands on you, and you have to sort of respect that, because if they dip out, it's like a really big hit. Whereas with escorting, not the case at all, because the guys are not visible to each other. They're not competing against each other in any way. Your income is like much more distributed across men.
Huh. Okay, so I'm curious, maybe this might be just a clarification point for us versus something that we include in the actual video, but escorting, is it sort of seen as prostitution plus? Is it seen as like, what's the, people use different terms to refer to different things. Escorting to me, or maybe in the way that it's talked about pop culture wise, implies a certain amount of going to an event, going to a, on a date with somebody, going out in public with them. What does escorting mean as you describe it or as you've experienced it?
Often when I talk to people and they ask me what I do, I will say prostitute specifically.
Oh, okay.
Because escorting is kind of confusing for the reasons that you mentioned. Like, people are like, do you just go with them to a party? Like, what are you actually having sex with them? Is it a massage, right?
There's a vagueness to the term, which I imagine could be somewhat convenient socially,
yes.
But it's also a little bit confusing.
Right. Yeah. I think escorting, like the term escort, has a slightly higher end connotation. But like in practice, it doesn't feel like distinct enough for me to make a distinction personally.
Well, so there are a whole bunch of different class differences in types of sex work that rarely get discussed. And I know you've sort of gestured at some of this, especially because you have such an intensive screening process for your clients. And you've really talked, I remember at Hereticon, a conference in Miami for basically thought criminals, so to speak, people like us who aren't really scared of entertaining absurd and wild ideas. You were talking on stage about how it's, you know, there are a lot of different class differences, and about how you've actually found that you're able to really earn a ton of money from your clients and also be highly selective with this, which ends up making sex work an awful lot safer. What does this look like? Like, could you talk a little bit about the class differences in types of sex work or types of prostitution?
Yeah, I did a survey of a bunch of escorts, basically, and found that, like, the amount of bad things they encountered, like sexual assault or theft or, you know, police or whatever, was, like, pretty strongly correlated with their price range, like the amount of money that they charge per hour. So basically, the more money you charge, you're sort of like pricing yourself out of like more sketchy clientele. The people who are going to be paying you $1,000 an hour are not going to sexually assault you. They're like a lawyer or a doctor or a politician or something who just like just don't want to fuck with that.
But is this available to everyone? Like, what's the way that people can get into that?
You mean, how do people raise their prices?
How do people specifically get involved in higher end sex work in order to attempt to curb some of those risks? Like, right. It seems like you made a somewhat deliberate decision as you sort of went from the factory to camming and then to escorting, and then you became highly selective with your clients. I imagine some of this is partially due to you being in high demand, but also some of this seems like a deliberate choice on your end to try to make this situation safe for you and to allow yourself to have a lot of autonomy in terms of who you choose. It seems like you sort of opted into high-end sex work in a very deliberate manner. Is that correct?
To some extent, yeah. I started charging about $800 an hour, and then I eventually rose my prices to $1,200.
Did you notice a big difference between clients, like the clientele that you that sought you out at $800 versus the higher end?
Yeah, it wasn't a massive difference, but there was definitely noticeable. Like, there were definitely guys I was like, ugh, all right, this is job, this is work, let's just, like, think of our happy place, right?
And yeah, how price-sensitive are these clients?
Yeah, I mean, some of the great ones tend to be less price-sensitive in general. And when I raised my prices, the kind of guys that were really a drudge to deal with typically faded out. Not, you know, 100%, but there were definitely way fewer of them.
Have you ever experimented with pricing to such an extent where you raise your prices so high that so many people get priced out that it ends up not becoming lucrative? Like, have you experimented with the upper end of that?
This is what I'm doing right now, actually. Because right now I've switched to researching. Like, I'm funded to do research right now. So I've basically quit sex work. And so I was like, fuck it, I'm going to raise my prices like really high because that's just sort of for fun.
Yeah.
Because I still really like escorting. Like, it's still a fun experience. And sometimes I'm noticing myself missing it. Like, it's a really easy, great way to have sex with a new person for some benefits on the side too. So I'm doing that right now. And so I do have some interest. Yeah.
May I ask, what's your price right now?
$3,000 an hour.
Have you noticed any demand?
Yes. Okay. Definitely reduced, but yes, it's still there.
What is your screening process for sex work look like?
Pretty standard. This is pretty standard across escorts. Typically, you ask for two references. So they're supposed to give you the names and emails of two other sex workers they've seen, usually in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. And you basically look those sex workers up and you email them. And also, you can do other things like ask them for proof of employment. Sometimes you can like call their work residence and be like, does, you know, Joe Smith work here? And then they'll be like, yeah. And you're like, thank you. And just to make sure they're not a police. Because the two things you want to check for to make sure they're not a cop and make sure that they don't like beat up women. And so those are what you do.
Yeah. And worst case scenario would be they're both of those.
Yes.
So you moved away from escorting and toward retirement. How did that transition happen? Because it seems like you've really carved out a huge space for yourself online, both in your writing and on Twitter, as this sort of like rationalist, public intellectual data collector. And so it's, I think it's very rare to have somebody who is such an authority and who engages in sex work, but who is also this almost like data scientist type. What has this sort of dual identity been like for you? And did that influence your retirement, basically?
Yeah, they really go hand in hand. I'm surprised more sex workers aren't also data scientists. Like, I went from escorting to OnlyFans because COVID hit, and it was like right before COVID hit, I got a client sick with the flu accidentally. And I was like, okay, I don't want to risk this again. This would be really bad. I don't want to kill anybody. So I stopped that and went into OnlyFans. And OnlyFans, you get a very large reach. OnlyFans, you have to just like get as many followers as many platforms as you can. And that really blew up my ability to do surveys with really high sample sizes. So I just started doing that. Even I had been doing it before, but at this point I was doing it even more.
Wait, so your platform became larger via OnlyFans? Like, you were getting survey results, you were having your OnlyFans followers be your respondents? Or was it that your profile overall was blowing up and so that OnlyFans fame translated to Twitter?
It's something like, in order to do OnlyFans very well, OnlyFans has a 50% churn rate of subscribers per month. Which means that 80% of the work that I did with OnlyFans was generating new eyes on this constantly, like very high visibility, which meant that I was capturing followers, free followers on a lot of platforms. Like, I have 350,000 followers on Reddit, for example, and like almost 200 on FetLife, 200,000. And so I had like a lot of platforms with like lots of subscribers on all of them. And that was what gave me the ability to do the surveys. They don't even have to be on my OnlyFans. I needed a lot in order to convert to my OnlyFans, but when I wanted to actually run a survey, I would post links to the survey in all of these places.
Oh, so you'd be cross-posting it on these different venues.
Yes.
Okay. And so what did that look like? Like, were you worried initially that people would think that it was weird or a distraction from the sexual content? It's like, oh, you know, do these people want to take a survey or respond to a poll, or do they just want titties? Like, were you worried about brand confusion here?
Not necessarily, because one aspect of selling sex to men is that you're selling them an identity about themselves, right? That men like to think of themselves as the kind of guy who likes this kind of girl, even if they don't actually like it, really, even if they don't independently pursue data themselves. So if you're like, hey, I'm a sex worker, and also I do data, they're like, wow, I'm such a high-end guy that I like am attracted to this hot woman who also does data. Look how like deep I am, right? So this is also selling the guys an identity for who they want to be. And so I think it actually helped.
So we met at Hereticon, this conference in Miami, which is sort of a gathering for oddball intellectuals. And you were on stage and you made the really interesting comment, I don't really get that mad when I'm sexually assaulted. The interviewer, who shall remain nameless, sort of got really uncomfortable and let out like an awkward chuckle and then moved on very quickly, which I thought was a sort of odd response because I was like, wait, that's, you know, a very heretical thing in our society, especially in the current moment. And I think that's so interesting. Like, I want nothing more than to understand what you mean by that, because I think I can get a sense of what you mean and I relate to it very much. What I took it to mean was there are a lot of gray areas of consent. So why don't you get that mad when you're sexually assaulted?
That's a great question.
Now's your opportunity to expand on it. You know, I thought you were shortchanged then.
I'm not sure. It's probably a couple different reasons. Like, one is I suspect that I just am, like, not very sensitive to negative stimuli. Like, if you do, like, a bad thing to me, I'm like, ah, okay, and I move on with my life. And so there's some sort of, like, predisposition, maybe genetic there, that just, it rolls off me pretty well. But another is that, like, but typically when I've been sexually assaulted, it hasn't resulted in, like, meaningful damage to me. Like, I'm not, you know, it doesn't break a leg, and I don't get pregnant or anything. And it's, like, annoying. I don't like it. But it doesn't feel like it really sticks in me very much. It's like, well, if nothing bad happened, then I can just move on with my life. And it also depends on the context a lot. Like, I've been sexually assaulted while working as an escort before. And that was, like, pretty unpleasant, but also it's like, it feels kind of an extension of what I'm doing already a little bit. That I feel like people are going to, if they hear that, they're going to misinterpret that online.
What do you mean by that, though? I think that's really interesting. Does it feel sort of like, to some degree, you're suspending a sense of what you want to do in order to engage in this voluntary relationship, this transaction? And so, you know, this being assaulted or having that be violated further is a natural extension of that?
Yeah, something like that. And to be clear, I do not view escorting as in itself as sexual assault whatsoever. Yeah. But it's something like maybe
but you're suspending sometimes your own needs and desires, I imagine, in order to do something that you've contractually agreed to.
Right. My guess would be if you're like, say you're hired to like load a bunch of boxes into a truck and you're like loading boxes and it's like not you're consenting to it. It's not like you're the most fun thing ever, but like whatever, that's life. And then like somebody comes along as you're lifting something and like dumps a whole bunch more weight on the thing that you're lifting. And it's like, you're still like in the context where you're doing the thing. And then the situation sort of changes to become more unpleasant. And in that case, like, sure, it's not great. You didn't consent to it. Like, that shouldn't have happened. But maybe it's like a little bit easier to handle because it's a slight modification of what you're doing already.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think this also is super related to you've been conducting a rape survey online, sort of in your role as this data scientist and public intellectual, and I found it really fascinating. Basically, it details all kinds of gray areas of consent, sometimes sex where one person isn't fully into it, but they still say yes. Sometimes sex where the deals of the transaction sort of change, where somebody's misled another person. Sex where one person sort of wants to get something out of the transaction or the interaction, but they ultimately don't get that. So I think it's interesting because our culture is so focused nowadays on consent and trauma and unpacking what those things mean. But it almost seems like what you're reacting to is a sense that a trauma or an event that is disturbing or that you dislike doesn't have to be something that wields so much power over mm-hmm. you for years and years to come, which I think runs very contrary to the cultural moment that we're in.
Yeah, this seems absolutely true. I think like the majority of trauma is like culturally determined. I'm not saying that we should say things that are good to make people who suffer them like have a good time. But I am saying that like a lot of the actual sensation of like, oh shit, I'm traumatized by this event comes from the sense that this should not have happened. And that is something that society tells you. Like, I was pretty abused when I was growing up by my dad. Mm-hmm. And when I got to be an adult, everybody was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. They reacted with like such sympathy and care and stuff. And that caused me to view my childhood as very bad. Because mm-hmm. before it had just been like, oh, this is kind of painful. Like this sucks. But like everybody has to do things they don't like in childhood, right? And then it was only once I got to adulthood that culture reframed this for me. And it was in that reframing that I experienced trauma from it. And in order to undo that trauma in myself, I had to undo that framing. Hmm. And so I think that the same goes with sexual assault and consent, right? Like the trauma of the consent, a lot of it, I mean, not all of it, to be clear, there are like concrete bad things that are not determined by society. But a lot of that trauma is coming from culture telling us like, oh, you should be pretty upset about that thing. And then our brains are like, okay, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think lots of women have had sort of experiences similar to that, where it's like, okay, consent was violated in some form, and we can quibble over the terms that we use to describe that. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, to what degree are we going to allow this to be part of our narrative about ourselves mm-hmm. going forward? And how much control, how much power should it really have over us in the future? But so you've been conducting this rape survey for a really long time. And how many respondents have you had? What have the findings been? This basically, I mean, I took it because I thought it was fascinating. And so it was some like 50 questions and basically a sliding scale, a continuum, where you rank the degree to which it sort of counts as rape versus doesn't. I think it was on a scale of like 1 to 10.
1 to 100, but yeah.
Okay, 1 to 100. So what were your findings?
Yeah, I had about 5,500 people take the survey and found a wide spectrum of things, I guess. Some like easily packaged things are like women tended to be more likely to rate things as rape than men. And
By what degree? By what factor?
What is the correlation? Let me see.
And we can have some pauses here to sort of chop things up.
But I can say women's average rating was 54 out of 100 and men's was 44 out of
100. I think mine was probably around the guy response level, like maybe in the 40s. So what types of things were you surprised that people considered to be rapey versus what types of things were you surprised that people sort of broadly found to be permissible? Or maybe permissible isn't the right framing for it, but less violating of consent.
I was surprised that... I included two controls, or what I thought were controls. One was like, okay, a question is very, very clearly rape, like somebody jumps out of a bush, is a stranger, they scream and stuff. And the other one was like, you have sex in a relationship to make your partner happy. I was like, that's clearly not rape. That's clearly a zero. Like nobody, like everybody has sex in their relationship to make a partner happy. And it was rated pretty low, but it wasn't zero. It got rated 13. There was, in fact, another one that got rated even lower than that, which was having sex with an unenthusiastic sex worker, which I thought people were going to rate higher than that. That was very surprising to me.
Interesting. What types of things were sort of universally declared rape by people?
Jumping out of bushes and screaming and fighting. Removing a condom without consent was
stealthing.
Pretty high up there. Stealthing, yeah. Okay. Yeah, or like a husband forcing sex on his wife, even if the wife thinks this is okay, or it comes from a culture where this is okay.
Interesting. I feel like that's maybe a response that like would be affected by whether people are US-based or international, because I wonder whether in some cultures where like marital rape laws have been either are still in place or were more recently repealed, whether people have slightly different cultural attitudes toward that.
Yeah. I also suspect, I suspect that there's like, this is one spectrum along which people evaluate if something is rape or not. Like, to what degree does like the person thinking that it's normal make it okay? Like, if both people involved are like, this is a normal thing to do, like, does it still count as rape? And this is, like, one thing that seemed to divide people.
You asked a lot of questions, if I recall, about people who are neurodivergent or otherwise, like, or disabled, and the degree to which they're sort of capable of consenting to sex. What did you find about that? I thought that was really interesting because that's a component of this that I think people really rarely fixate on. And I can understand why, because I imagine that's a relatively small part of the overall pie of sexual interactions. But I thought that was really interesting to sort of consider how much agency does a person who is disabled or intellectually divergent in some way, how much consent, how much ability to consent do they have? What did you find there?
What did I find? Like, it seemed to be, like, roughly in the middle. People had different views on it. But one thing about this that I find interesting, like, one reason why, like, mental capacity seems really fascinating to me is because we have a lot of opinions about, like, teenagers, you know, or children, like, their ability to consent to sex. And generally, the perception is, no, they can't, but maybe, like, a 16-year-old could have sex with another 16-year-old and this is fine. But, like, the reason why we say children cannot consent to sex is because they don't have the mental capacity to agree. So I'm like, okay, what if we take a mentally disabled person who has the mental capacity of a 16-year-old for their entire life, right? And so do our intuitions say the same there? Like, should we never allow them to have sex with anyone? And so that's a really good way of like testing our intuitions about this.
And what do people's intuitions say about that?
They say... they're much more likely to be okay with neurodivergent or mentally disabled people having sex than they are teens.
Interesting. And was that a matter, like, did you pull them on teens having sex with other teens or teens having sex with adults?
I had a teen having sex with adults question.
Okay.
In the question, this was like at least visibly eager, like the 16-year-old expressed being very excited about this thing. And then I also asked a question about somebody with Down syndrome, very eagerly wanting to have sex with somebody who is neurotypical. And it was not considered rape, very, very, very low for the Down syndrome person, but it was considered pretty rapey for the 16-year-old.
That's fascinating. Yeah. That's so different than how I would anticipate those responses to go.
Yeah.
What other big gender differences did you see other than the sort of top line men tended to rate things as less rapey than women did on average? What other gender differences did you see? Were there any themes that came up where men generally regarded something as permissible, whereas women didn't?
Yeah. It was surprising to me, relationship pressure was a big one. So scenarios that involve some level of like emotional desire for sex or asking for sex when the woman doesn't want to, typically in this context of a relationship, men were very much like, that's not rape. And women were like, that is definitely more rapey, which was pretty surprising to me.
Huh. Okay. So at Hereticon, you talked about how you don't, you're not generally in favor of government intrusion into sex and into people's sex lives. But you did mention that you would sooner have, if you had to, you would sooner have the government regulate OnlyFans than regulate in-person sex work. Mm. Why is that?
Right. If we're going by the, like, how much harm does this cause the population sort of thing, my guess, my intuition is that OnlyFans, like, might be more damaging to society as a whole than escorting. And to be clear, both of them are not very damaging.
Yeah.
I think it's worth it.
We're not really
there.
In favor of state intrusion into people's sex lives, generally, right. As a principle in this room.
Yeah. But OnlyFans seems worse to me, mostly in the sense that it feels much more impersonal and asymmetrical. It feels more like a system of sex as opposed to like genuine sexual interaction. Like with escorting, there's a very human thing. It feels very organic. And I feel like a little bit like a hippie talking about this. I'm not typically very hippie-like except for all of the LSD. But it really does feel different. Like when I went from camming to escorting to OnlyFans, the escorting felt the healthiest to me. Like I felt the best after doing it. I felt like I was doing the most good in the world. Whereas the other two are very asymmetrical. It's me versus like a whole bunch of guys.
Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to let you know about a great live event Reason is hosting in New York City on Monday, May 2nd at the Caveat Theater. I'm going to be talking with Faisal Saeed Al-Matar and Melissa Chen, the outspoken and courageous co-founders of Ideas Beyond Borders. It's a nonprofit that translates books about pluralism, science of liberties, and critical thinking into Arabic, and then distributes them for free as ebooks throughout the Middle East. They're also translating thousands of Wikipedia pages, and the books they're bringing to Arabic speakers are works like John Stuart Mill's On Liberty and Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now. Ideas Beyond Borders is also funding schools for girls in Afghanistan and helping to get people out of there who are on the Taliban's enemies list. These are real heroes, and they've got incredible personal stories to tell, so you won't want to miss it on Monday, May 2nd at Caveat Theater in New York City. Tickets are $10 and must be purchased online. Go to reason.com/events for details. I hope to see you there. And now, back to the Reason interview.
I'm fascinated by this because I think it's counter how a lot of people, maybe not libertarians and people who are pro-sex work, but the idea that escorting is doing good in the world runs counter to how a lot of people view it. But you're saying you felt that really viscerally. What did that feel like to you? How would you describe that feeling to somebody who's perhaps opposed to it?
Oh, well, it feels much more dehumanizing to be on OnlyFans. And again, happy OnlyFans exists. This is not a criticism. But it did feel like I was actually dehumanizing the men more and they were dehumanizing me. Because it's about numbers. We have 50% churn. We're like, I'm thinking about funnels. I'm thinking about like how many eyes, what's the conversion rate? I'm thinking about like at what time of day do I post this thing to get the most unlocks? That sort of thing. And so the men are no longer like individual men, right? They're like little data points in a thing that I'm trying to maximize. I'm no longer interacting with a human. I'm interacting with like a mass of ants on the ground that I'm trying to like corral into giving me their money. And
it's like that terrible movie, The Social Network, where Vincent Kartheiser has like all the computer monitors and is like pulling all the levers. And it's like, that's how you're looking at OnlyFans as opposed to escorting.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's fun. Like I OnlyFans is like fun in that kind of way, but it definitely is removing some sort of human element from the sexual interaction in a way that is like impossible to do with escorting. Like with escorting, you're just placed in front of a human being and you like make eye contact and you talk with each other and get to know each other. And then like, that is just powerful in a way that like I can't replicate anywhere else.
You said there's a component of almost therapy you're doing and selling men to some degree an image of themselves. What was that like more specifically in escorting? Like, do you have examples of that, of like these deeper sort of connections that you made?
Yeah, there are definitely several men that I knew that like I still think about really fondly to this day. Like there's guys who, I think there were two dying of cancer and were like, I don't want to die without having the warm embrace of a woman in my life. I was like, sure, I'm like fully for you to help with that. Or there was one guy who was like really depressed and our first session, like, we sat down on the bed and we were talking, and it just felt to me like there was like sadness behind him. And then I just asked about that, and then one thing led to another, and the entire session was just like me holding him as he sobbed into me. And that was it. We didn't have sex. I've had sex with a quadriplegic who was like literally in a chair who couldn't move. And I was like, yeah, that feels good. Like, I'm helping you get something that just you can't get anymore. It feels really human and caring to me.
You've talked a little bit about what percentage of your clients are married and how it's actually a pretty high number, and about how people's the popular perception of married men going to see sex workers is that their marriage is failing, and that sex work, you know, seeking the love of a woman outside of the marriage is merely a way to slap a Band-Aid onto deeper problems. But you've commented before that, A, we put Band-Aids onto deeper problems all the time, and sometimes that's a reasonable and good thing to do. Mm-hmm. And also, B, that sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean a marriage is decrepit and fully atrophied, but rather that there's a very specific sexual incompatibility that then you're able to help repair. How do you think about that and this phenomenon of married men seeking you out?
Oh, you did a fantastic job summarizing it. But yeah, basically exactly that. In my survey, about 50% of men who seek out escorts are married. And this seems to hold true with my personal experience. And often they would talk very fondly about their wives, be like, my wife is great, like, I never want to hurt her. And it felt very compartmentalized. A lot of times men did go to escorts specifically because of that compartmentalization, right? They don't want to like have an affair with somebody at work who might like bleed into their life and actually like pull out more of their emotional resources. They want a sex experience that they can like put on the shelf and go away, because often they care about their wife and they want to protect their wife from any sort of like bleed over. They're like, oh, the thing that I'm not getting is sex. I'm just going to go have that. And that's it. But it feels absolutely right to me what you said. Like, usually older men whose wives just are not sexually interested anymore, like have a very low sex drive maybe, or too exhausted. It's just not for them. And the guy doesn't want to pressure her to like make her have sex with him. And she usually is very uncomfortable if he would have sex with anybody else or opening the relationship. So what can he do to get his needs met? And a lot of people are like, well, you signed up for this, you know, you committed to a life with this woman. But really, I think culture does not adequately prepare people for this. They're just like, oh, you're going to be in love forever and it's going to be fine. But it's not. And these people are blindsided by it. And so in order to cope with this, they often go and see an escort. And this can help them preserve a marriage that may have fallen apart if they didn't do something like this.
So you initially started sending out these polls on all of your different platforms, your Reddit and your OnlyFans and your Twitter, to try to get as many respondents as possible. But that really snowballed into something bigger. It wasn't just an exercise in brand differentiation for you, where guys ended up being into it, but it's also like a thing that you are known for. And you've sort of established a reputation for yourself as this data scientist. Tell me more about how that evolved.
Yeah, I've been sort of dabbling in it for a very long time. I think I did my first survey in like 2014. And in hindsight, it was really terrible. I was just like, let's ask people questions. And then I didn't understand about like question structure or how to process data afterwards or anything. I'm not formally educated. I was homeschooled and did not really go to college. So all of this has been self-taught or through like tutors or friends who've helped me. So my knowledge is pretty spotty and I'm learning all the time. I'm like pretty good in some areas and like really underdeveloped in others.
Which areas are you good at?
I think I'm really good at like deeply understanding stuff like correlation and like the ways data can lie to you. A lot of people who criticize my surveys online, I feel like usually miss the mark. I'm like, you don't understand like why that criticism makes sense. I like selection bias, for example. I'm like, selection bias is something that you want to level like very specifically. Like, there's reasons. I can go into this, it's a whole rant. I'm like mad at
people. Give me your abridged rant. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, the rant is basically like a very common criticism I get on my surveys. It's like, this is like selection bias. Like, you can't trust the things, the results you're getting because you surveyed people on Twitter. And I'm like, okay, there's a reason why selection bias is bad, right? And it's because the population that you're sampling is meaningfully different from the average population. And this is true for a lot of things. Like, if you're asking about video games and you're only surveying men, of course it's going to be like very different from the average population. But if you're doing something like a correlation that seems to be like pretty like distinct from what the population that you're asking about, like, for example, if you're like, do you drink water is one of the questions, like more than 8 glasses a day or something. And another question is like, do you go to work or something? I don't know. But and there's like, it's like the correlation is like 0.3 or something. And you're like, well, you only survey people on Twitter, not people on, you know, from Facebook or something. I'm like, why would that? You have to give me a theory for why Twitter selects for people who both drink water and go to work, right? Like why that correlation exists specifically on Twitter and not on Facebook. What people don't know is that they're giving me an alternative hypothesis. When you say selection bias, what you're actually doing is presenting an alternate theory for the way that the world is. And if that theory is like a little bit absurd, then you have to actually defend it. I'm like, okay, well, explain to me like why you think that this correlation is appearing specifically in this population and not others. But generally, people do not deeply understand why selection bias is bad. And so they just level this criticism at anything that has sort of a selective population that it's sampling. And this is like one example where I have this sense that I feel like I understand statistics better than a lot of people, at least deeply in that sense. But I'm also like not very good at some other things. Like I'm still learning about factor analysis, for example, or like eliminating confounding factors.
So what other surveys have you done recently? Like what's the most interesting findings that you've had in the last 6 months?
I did one recently about sex trafficking. I wanted to know how many people are actually sex trafficked.
This is something we have terribly bad, like terribly unreliable data on, and Reason, my colleague Elizabeth Nolan Brown, has done a ton of unpacking of this, because we always see this, especially around Super Bowl time, where it's like, you know, some crazy number of women are sex trafficked, and it's like, well, are we actually dividing out between high demand for sex work and in a specific city where the Super Bowl's happening versus women being held in warehouses and moved in moving vans or whatever? So what have you found?
Right. I mean, Elizabeth's work is great on this. And I went in, found very similar things. Like I read the sources on Wikipedia that were listed for how many people. And I went and read those studies, which quoted other studies, which I went. And basically the fundamental, the bottom of all of it is just complete shit. It's like literally one of them, which ended up being quoted by everybody, is like one of the very popular numbers. It's like some guy in like one dude in a warehouse, like in the 80s, who made some estimate and didn't tell anybody how he made it. And like that's just the number that's getting reported around. So I found that it was like basically pretty terrible. So what I did is I went and I tried to find estimates that seemed kind of reasonable, listed a lot of them, and averaged them. But I also did a survey, which is a who do you know survey. So the way this works is I asked a whole bunch of people, do you know somebody who has basically been sex trafficked? And then you can say, yes, it was me. Yes, it was a friend. Yes, an acquaintance, or no. And this gives you basically an average score. If you like, I weighted them differently. Like if it's me, it's like a high score. If it's like an acquaintance, then it's a low score. And in order to check this, I also asked a whole bunch of other questions about things we do know the actual rates for, like lung cancer or being a doctor or winning the lottery or something. So I had basically a whole bunch of questions where I knew the actual rates that were corresponding to the score that people were giving. So I'm like, do you know anybody who's an Orthodox Jew? And I'm like, the average score is like, I don't know, like 0.8 or something.
For New Yorkers, it's like, yeah, I know like 20 people who are Orthodox Jews.
And so I'm like, okay. And then I looked at how many actual Orthodox Jews. And so I could see the correlation there. And so I made a chart of the correlations. And basically this gave me like a predicted amount of sex workers in the US that are trafficked based on the amount of people who knew about them or were reporting. And obviously there's like some problems with this. This is just an estimate. Like this is not like an excellent way of going about it. But like compared to what we already have, like a guy in a warehouse in the 80s, like at least it's a movement in the right direction. Yeah. And so basically my total estimate for how many sex workers are currently actively trafficked in the US is around 37,000.
Okay. Out of how many total sex workers?
I also did an estimate for this. This is also something that's very difficult for people to know. I did another survey of sex workers in which I asked them, have you ever been arrested? And I found the rate of arrests in sex workers I asked was like around 8% or something. And then I went and I looked at national arrest rates of people arrested for sex. So I know the total amount of people who've been arrested for sex within like the correct period of time or whatever. And then I know that 8% of my sex workers reported being arrested. So I could extrapolate from that an estimate of how many total sex workers there are in the US. And this led me to an estimate of around 830,000 sex workers. I also did for the Who Do You Know survey, where I estimated the amount have been sex trafficked. I also regressed, like had a prediction from that for how many sex workers are there. Because I also asked, do you know anybody who's a sex worker? And the estimate from that was, I think, 1,200,000.
Oh, interesting.
So one estimate that I had was around 800,000. That was like, you know, 1.2 million.
What are official estimates?
All over the place. Okay. Sometimes it's really high, sometimes really low. I did find a couple of estimates, official estimates, that like I thought were like maybe okay, and it was around a million.
Okay, interesting. So these are all sort of ballparking into the same place.
Right. So my final estimate after like averaging those two numbers that I came up with and a couple like surveys that seemed like maybe they were kind of reasonable was around a million.
So how did you define sex trafficking? You said 83,000?
37,000.
37. You said 37,000 are sex trafficked, and then you're talking about somewhere roughly near 1 million total sex workers. So proportion-wise, that's a relatively small number, which isn't to say that we ought to diminish that, because anybody's agency being violated is something that we take very seriously. But that's decent evidence to indicate that this problem takes an outsized place in the sort of American moral panic imagination.
Right. I think the percentage that I found was like 3.5% of all sex workers in the U.S. are trafficked is my estimate.
And what did you define trafficking as?
So I didn't define it in the survey.
Okay.
When I asked people who do you know, I just said, do you know anybody who's a sex worker? Do you know anybody who's been sex trafficked? Mm-hmm. And I did not define trafficking in that survey. I was careful about this definition of sex trafficking when I looked into estimates myself. Like I ignored studies that like it was kind of, they did not distinguish if the workers were doing it voluntarily.
Huh. Interesting. In a world where AILA makes the rules, what types of cultural norms would you like to see surrounding how we think about sex and or how sex is regulated or perhaps deregulated?
That's a large question. Obviously deregulation would be great. Generally, I prefer like individual autonomy over like any sort of regulation there. So if you want to go sell your body on the sex market, go for it. Good for you. I would prefer people to be like a little bit more flexible about how they think about sexual trauma. Like be not necessarily that you're trying to tell people that they are not traumatized, but rather that you're more open to the idea that maybe you don't have to be traumatized. There's a lot more flexibility for actually finding out the way people genuinely feel about their sexual experiences before trying to tell them how they should be feeling about it. Feels like a great norm to me.
What are your greatest hopes and fears for the future of sex, either the future of sex work or the future of our cultural norms around sex? Where do you think it's going to go?
I'm pretty hopeful about it. Like our trajectory so far has been towards greater sexual permission. Mm-hmm. And like likely there's going to be sort of up and down waves as we get better about it. So like in the short term, it may in fact get worse, but I'm pretty optimistic for it overall. Like sexual permission comes out of like losing consequences for sex. We no longer get pregnant when we have sex, which is incredible, unless we want to.
Or unless we go to Heretticon and are like an idiot.
I know, as I say that, I was like, what?
It's like, God damn it.
Or if you're at Heretticon and you're an idiot, like there's like a small...
Yeah, like somebody was in a lot of hot tubs with various... it's my husband's, which is great. Great news. Continue though. Definitely, if you could do like a little bit on like fears for ways in which this could be fucked up and in which we could go in a fucked up direction, and then a little bit of like rounding out with like the sort of future is optimistic type thing, because I think that's sort of a shared ethos that you have and that Reason has.
Yeah.
But a little bit about like ways in which our society threatens to err, or our laws threaten to err, and then ways in which things are going fucking awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, throughout all of human history, if you have sex, it makes a baby, and pretty scary. It makes sense that we had a bunch of like fucked up rules to try and govern that. But we no longer have that. And now for the first time, humanity's like, we can fuck without babies. And it's leading to some really weird stuff. And like to some like negative outcomes too. Like if you just sort of release a pressure on a population, you get like a whole bunch of things, some positive, some negative. And so, yeah, there's some like possible really negative outcomes that might come from this, especially with people's reaction to it. Like people are not sort of like evolutionary, like in a physical sense, like ready for there to be like a whole bunch of sex happening all the time with whoever you want, you know, like the sex utopia or something, which makes sense. It's reasonable. But like a lot of people have backlash to this by like maybe imposing like draconian laws that are like supposedly meant to protect women, you know, while simultaneously victimizing them.
I'm thinking of like Joe Biden's like Violence Against Women Act and stuff like that, that attempts to protect women who are victims of domestic violence, but ends up actually inviting the police into all sorts of domestic altercations in a manner that sometimes doesn't actually help the victims.
Right. And I think that this is a great example of like a theme, which is like, oh, we're starting to see a negative outcome. And we try in our sort of like incompetent but good good intentioned way to try to implement some sort of law to fix it. But it's just like a series of like band-aids on a pretty deep problem. And usually I think that problems are better left to sort of like sort themselves out. If you can do that, like without like creating any force on it.
And what are ways in which you think the coming sex utopia will actually be wonderful? Like what are ways in which you think the future of sex is actually going to be really wonderful, other than the fact that we're sort of just generally getting freer and freer from consequences to do what we want?
Yeah, I would love people to be able to get their needs met when they need to. Like, I think the institution of monogamy is great for some reasons and pretty misleading in others. Like I mentioned earlier, people go into monogamy without fully understanding that they're going to have to spend a life, you know, like sexually tied to just this partner, and that people change really drastically. And we have no affordance, no room for people to try to get their needs met in that sort of situation. So I'm hoping in the future we are much more like flexible and understanding about this sort of thing, that we sort of decouple like abnormal sexual behavior from threat. Like, oh, you can do this thing that is not like standard accepted, and like bad things are not going to happen. Like I hope that we as a culture will sort of like actually like feel that hit us in a deep way and then move according to that.
Do you think that will happen?
I suspect so. I don't, assuming that we don't all die in like some sort of horrific AI extinction, like it might take a couple centuries, but I suspect we're moving in that direction. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really sad if the AI extinction happened before the sexual utopia.
Yes.
So as libertarians, we want these things to happen all at once, you know, right. we want to enjoy some of the fruits of our labors. Okay, so I have a few rapid fire questions that I want to go to. And so these are basically like 1 to 2 sentence, like really keep it concise in your answers. Unless there is one that you like legitimately want to expand upon, in which case we can sort of pause and expand, and then chop that up and put that in the normal interview. But I sort of conceived of these as like, you know, just like shooting the shit type things, mm-hmm. almost like Tyler Cowen style, though I'm not nearly as cute as he is. So why do you think you've gained such traction with the tech crowd specifically?
I think I'm more analytically minded than a lot of other sex workers.
Recently, you had a Twitter thread on basically party planning tips, mm-hmm. but it was all really about human connection and basically how to foster an environment in which people are actually really at ease in a way that they're typically not when interacting with strangers. What's the best party you've ever thrown, and why was it so good?
There's different kinds of best. There's like most interesting, probably the naked mask party. The most like...
A COVID mask or?
No, it was okay. Just before COVID. The dress code was you had to wear a full face mask and be completely naked. And that was really interesting.
Could you tell who people were based on their bodies?
Sometimes, but not a lot. Some people came to that thing and left, and I had no idea who they were. I only found out later.
Do you think that gave them more comfort with coming?
Maybe. I'm not sure. It was pretty awkward. But it was really interesting awkward, and I really enjoyed that.
Wait, I want to stay on this for a second. Wait, so... What was awkward about it? Like, did people just sort of not fully embrace the situation, or was it a matter of like physical discomfort where they didn't know whether they should like sit on a couch or not?
I think it was a combination of both. Like being naked is sort of vulnerable and can make people sort of like freeze up a little bit. And also being unable to access other people's faces, like you can't see their facial expressions, like is sort of distancing in some way. And so the combination of these two just sort of had everybody like sitting on the couch. And it was, of course, mostly rationalists. Which didn't help. And so they're all just like sitting on the couch, like having like deep intellectual philosophical conversations, like totally naked. It was really interesting.
Did it seem like men or women were more comfortable in this sort of weird alternate reality social format?
My guess is women. Usually, I've thrown lots of naked parties, mm-hmm. And usually women seem to be more okay with it.
This sounds lovely to me because it's like an incentive to work out for weeks and weeks beforehand, but then you don't actually have to do your makeup before going out, which sounds really lovely.
Yeah.
It seems like properly aligned incentives to keep your skin healthy. Why do you think people are averse to plastic surgery, but oftentimes not other forms of body modification?
That's a great question. I'm not like fully sure. I think there's something of deception going on, like you're lying about the way that your genes are. It's also some sort of virtue signaling thing. Like if you truly are virtuous, like you don't even think about how you look. Like caring a lot about your appearance seems like very shallow. It's like that just doesn't matter. It's not tied to deeper meaning. Like why would you do that sort of thing?
What's an assumption people make about your work or your career trajectory that you dislike or you wish they wouldn't make?
Oh, there's a lot of those. I really don't like that people think that I'm doing it just to be edgy. I really deeply am curious and weird, and it feels very true and organic to me. And people from the outside often see what I'm doing and think, wow, she's like deliberately trying to provoke reactions in people, and that there's not much more to it.
Do you think if you'd had sort of a nicer initial workplace than a factory, you still would have gravitated towards sex work the way you did?
I think it's possible. I think I was always sort of like unhappy with my life in some deep way. I remember feeling like I could do more. It was always in the back of my head, like, I think I could really do something good if I just had the ability to. And if not sex work, I think it might have landed on something similar.
So one thing that we've been paying a lot of attention to at Reason is the backlash toward sex work and toward porn and this sort of push toward regulating a lot of these sites like OnlyFans and cracking down on payment processing capabilities of these sites. There's also been this really interesting sort of social conservative trad movement that's been bubbling up in the last few years that I imagine you have a lot of exposure to by being a very visible sex worker online. Mm-hmm. What are these objections like, and how have you addressed them in the past, or how do you look at addressing their objections?
Yeah, the objections are typically something like, this is damaging society in some way, or it's like an addiction that is like hurting your psyche. Mm-hmm. It's like damaging your ability to bond, to pair bond, to have intimacy, to love. And these don't feel true based on my personal experience. It's possible that they are true for some people. Like, I don't want to just outright be like, all of your criticisms are incorrect. But there's also a thing which I feel that they miss, which is like the trade-offs, right? Like we have a lot of trade-offs from driving cars. We have car accidents and pollution and stuff, but we consider it worth it, right? And I'm not going to say that, no, nobody dies from driving cars, but I'm also not going to be like, well, we should get rid of cars. Like for any sort of like new thing that we have instituted, there's going to be benefits to it and there's going to be cons. And the question is not, are there cons? The question is, are the benefits worth it? And so I feel like a lot of the criticisms I get are missing that. They're like, oh, well, there's cons. We should stop the cons. And I'm like, okay, yes, there's cons. But I'm not sure that like doing something that ruins the benefits is like worth it. Like a lot of people watch porn for a reason. Porn have been super beneficial to me in my life personally. And I'm like, I'd be like pretty pissed if people got rid of it.
How so? How has it been beneficial to you?
It's made me feel like less fucked up or something. Like I have like kind of odd sexual desires. And I study kinks, right? So like I talk to so many people who have odd sexual desires. And the existence of porn sort of like validates this in a way. You can be like, oh, I'm not like weird and abnormal. There are other people like me out there producing content for each other to make each other like happy and satisfied. And that seems really wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. Are you more worried about the social threat from this sort of like quickly, this trad movement that's quickly gaining traction, or are you more worried about the threat from politicians, people like Josh Hawley, who tend to really ride the wave of porn panic and attempt to oftentimes spread lies and misinformation about sex trafficking and stuff like that? Are you more worried about the cultural threat or the governmental threat? Do you see them as two sides of the same coin?
Yeah, they work in tandem, right? Like governments make laws based off of cultural pressure often. But like if I had to compare them, I would say I'm more afraid of the people that hold the power. And so this sounds like the politicians. I'm okay with cultural movements as long as they don't use force in them. Like I'm okay with people genuinely arguing, hey, I think this is harmful for you. Like I'm down to have this discussion. I'm down for you to make like a strong movement that sweeps the land. But I am not okay with you making laws that prevent me from doing what I feel is good for me. Like that is the border here. This is what like the respect of freedom is. So I'm fine with the culture, but like the thing is, I just like at this point don't trust the culture to be able to still respect freedoms of people they disagree with.
Do you see a tension between the fact that so much of the tech crowd is kind of a huge fan of yours and seems generally interested in some of these pro-sex work ideas, but then there's also this interesting almost trad wave that's sweeping a lot of that? To me, I sort of sometimes see the same people celebrating some things but almost heralding the sort of impending cultural crackdown.
Yeah, I'm glad that I exist for this or something. Like I've had a couple people tell me that I changed their perception of sex workers. Like, oh, I didn't know sex workers could be smart. Like, I've heard that phrase a couple times from different people. And so I think there's some sort of like humanizing that I'm doing and I'm bringing to it. And like maybe that this is sort of like helping provide some balance to the wave of trad coming through. But I don't know. The best I can do is just be honest and wait.
Thank you so much for talking to Reason.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. Or make it easy on yourself and just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.